Cześć, nazywam się Radek Orszewski i zapraszam Was na Kanban przy kawie. Podcast o tym, jak zwinnie, sprawnie i efektywnie zarządzać pracą. Witam Was serdecznie w kolejnym odcinku podcastu Kanban przy kawie. Z tej strony Radek Orszewski. Dzisiaj zgodnie z zapowiedziami z kilku poprzednich odcinków zaczynamy z epizodem zawierającym wywiad. Wywiad anglojęzyczny, który będzie na końcu okraszony tradycyjnie, jak w takim przypadku, moim komentarzem czy rozszerzeniem. Ale zanim wysłuchacie tego wywiadu, to chciałbym opowiedzieć dlaczego i o czym, bo temat nie jest mainstreamowy i mimo tego, że ma już prawie dwie dekady za sobą od powstania, to tak na dobrą sprawę nadal nie jest, powiedziałbym, odkryty i używany do tego, do czego świetnie się sprawdza. Będziemy dzisiaj mówić o mapach Wordleya, albo w języku angielskim też często mówimy o czasowniku Wordley mappingu, a więc mapowaniu Wordleya. No i kto lepiej o tym opowie niż sam twórca metody, czyli Simon Wordley. Ale poza laurką dla Simona, którą ten wywiad pewnie będzie z mojej strony, to oczywiście podejście praktyczne, co to właściwie jest, do czego to służy i co możemy tym zbudować. Opowiem o tym więcej po wywiadzie, tak żeby Was tym wywiadem zainteresować, bo Simon jest świetnym rozmówcą i mamy tam historię i Sun Tzu, i polski akcent w postaci Wedla i bardzo różne inne jeszcze historie. Natomiast chciałbym powiedzieć o tym, że mapy Wordleya to jest świetne narzędzie, które A, korzysta z wizualizacji, a więc jak najbardziej fanom, fankom Kanbanu, który na wizualizację stawia, na pewno może być za pan brat. Z drugiej strony pokazuje ewolucję tego, jak różnego rodzaju systemy czy rozwiązania się zmieniają, a więc znów nie jest to obraz statyczny, stąd może ten czasownik, czyli mapping. Oraz, co jest istotne, jest tak na dobrą sprawę zrzuceniem pewnego obrazu obecnej sytuacji, może też projekcji, jak to się będzie zmieniało w przyszłości, dzięki czemu możemy zacząć prowadzić dialog, zarówno jeżeli jesteśmy osobami technicznymi, biznesowymi, związanymi z, nie wiem, user experience czy tego typu rolami, i podyskutowanie o tej mapie, czy my się w ogóle zgadzamy, że jesteśmy tam, gdzie jesteśmy, trochę tak jak na mapie, oraz w którą stronę czy my, czy elementy, których używamy, będą szły. No, to brzmi trochę jeszcze tak abstrakcyjnie, ale moi drodzy, opowiem o tym szerzej po wywiadzie, ponieważ mapy Wordleya mogą być narzędziem, które budują właśnie pewien obraz krajobrazu wokół tego, co chcemy zrobić, czy jest to nowy program, nowa aplikacja, nowe doświadczenie użytkownika, nowa strategia firmowa, a może po prostu strona internetowa oferująca software as a service, i zastanowienie się, jakich podejść, jakich narzędzi, jakich tutaj właśnie rozwiązań, nawet często technicznych, powinniśmy użyć po to, żeby kupić się na wartości użytkownika, a nie tylko i wyłącznie na tym, co my dotąd umiemy najlepiej, bo okazuje się, że te rzeczy oczywiście mogą wcale nie iść w parze. Dla użytkownika może być istotne pewne doświadczenie, my możemy często oponować przeciwko jakiemuś rozwiązaniu, za jakimś rozwiązaniem opierać je, natomiast pytanie, czy wiemy, gdzie ono na tych osiach tej mapy. Zapraszam Was do wywiadu, a po nim kilka słów komentarza. Jeśli ten temat się okaże ciekawy, to być może zasłuży na drugi odcinek, to już od Was zależy. Today we have a guest episode, and our guest today is Simon Wordley. We usually ask our guests to introduce themselves, and we challenge them with a question. How do you explain to the others what you do professionally?
God, well, first of all, thank you ever so much for inviting me along. Absolutely delighted to be here. I'm Simon Wordley, and what do? I'm not going to say I teach people. I do a bit of teaching, but most of my stuff is practice. What I do is help people understand the landscape they're competing in. And by landscape, I don't mean geographical landscape. I mean economic, social, political landscape, or even the data landscape that they are actually operating in. Now, that sounds, what does that actually mean? And so I think the best way of explaining that is actually with the origin story. So
I'm sure there's a story behind it. So yeah.
Oh, well, there is, yeah.
Entertain us with the origin story.
So this all started in 2004. I was working for a company called Fatango, online photo service, very successful, lots of revenue growing. But it had a problem. The problem was the CEO. The CEO was completely and utterly clueless. Didn't know what they were doing.
I've heard that it's a problem in many companies. Sorry to interrupt. But yeah, we could be successful if only our CEO.
Yeah, well, our CEO was hopeless. And I know this for a fact, actually, that they were just making stuff up because I was the CEO. So I used to produce these wonderful vision statements and things like that. They were just like copied from other companies with a few words changed. I had no idea what I was doing. I hadn't done an MBA. I thought you learned all the magic secrets there. And, well, actually, these days, I actually teach it in various couple of business schools. But anyway, that's another story. So I was reading every book I could find in strategy. It was getting nowhere, absolutely nowhere. And I ended up in a bookshop in Charing Cross. And I was talking to the bookseller, and they said, I was explaining this problem that I had. I didn't know what I was doing. And she said, have you ever read Sun Tzu's The Art of War? And I hadn't. So I bought a couple of versions of the book, because they're all translations. And I was when I was reading this, and I'm so grateful for this bookseller persuading me to read this book, because I noticed there was a pattern. Sun Tzu talked about five factors that matter in competition. One, have a purpose, a moral imperative, what you're trying to do. Secondly, understand your landscape, your competitive environment, the land that you're fighting over or maybe collaborating with others over. Then understand how that landscape is changing, the weather, the climatic patterns, the heavens. Then you also need to understand principles of how you organize yourself. And then finally, you get into the chicken gate place. So you start off with purpose, landscape, climatic patterns, doctrine or principles, and then gameplay. And I was like looking at this and thought, great, how do I understand the landscape? And so I went back to my organization. I got everybody to send me all the, because I thought, need a map. I got them all to send me maps. And so I got loads of maps, business process maps, mind maps, systems maps, all this sort of stuff. And I was looking at one of these maps.
Mm-hmm.
It was a systems map for the actual online photo service. And I moved a component on the map. And I asked the question, how has the map changed? And the answer was, it hadn't. Because all I'd done is I moved a component, kept the nodes, the connections the same to the node, just physically moved it. But if I look at a geographic map and I take Australia and I shift it next to the UK, that has changed. Why hasn't my business process map changed, or my systems map in this case? And it turned out all of these maps that I had one thing in common. None of them were maps. They were all graphs. So to understand the difference, in a map, space has meaning, which is why it's good for understanding a landscape. A graph is simply nodes with connections between them. Okay, the landscape itself doesn't mean, the space doesn't mean anything. So I sort of assumed, this is back in 2004, 2005, this is my problem. You know, we're not communicating with maps in the organization. We don't have maps. This is obviously what you learn at MBA school, and I obviously missed that lesson completely because I didn't go. I never did an MBA. So I had to devise a way of mapping. So I developed Simon's cheap and cheerful way of doing it. It took me about, it must have been in total probably about a year, might be slightly more, including 6 months hiding away in a library at one point. That was just to refine it all. But it turned out that maps have some basic characteristics. You need an anchor like magnetic north. You need position of pieces. This is north, south, east, or west of this. And you need consistency of movement. So if you go north, you go north. You're not going south. So I simply recreated that in a business landscape. So I thought, right, my anchor is going to be the users of whatever it is, whether it's a healthcare system or a software system. There's going to be users. There's going to be the business. There's maybe government. There may be public. There may be regulators. They're going to be our anchors. And of course, all of them have needs, okay? And those needs need to be fulfilled somehow. So we've got a supply chain of components, and those components could be practices, data, knowledge, it could be, you know, pieces of technology, all sorts of things. Right, so now we've got anchor and a supply chain of components, or a chain of needs. All right, so we've got anchor and position. So this needs that, needs this. It's a partially ordered list. now I had to do consistency of movement. And it turned out that all of these forms of components were actually forms of capital. And they were all evolving through common four stages. So when we talk about physical activities, or, you know, technology, we talk about the genesis of the novel and new, custom-built examples, products and rental services, commodity and utility services. When we talk about praxis, novel, emerging, good and best, they've all got the same characteristics. So what I was able to do was put the stages at the bottom and just go through my chain of needs, saying, how evolved is this component? Is it genesis, custom-built product, commodity? And that creates them. Now, what I'm actually, bizarrely enough, doing is, when I look at most organizations, when we talk about what we are going to do, we actually run most organizations on stories. And unfortunately, we have a problem in the fact that there's an entire industry out there which says to people that, you know, a great leader is a great storyteller. And that creates the problem that when you challenge my story, you're challenging me as a leader. And so I get very, very defensive. Okay. Now, putting the story in a map, you can challenge the map without challenging the person. So I produce a map of a system. Somebody can look at it and say, I think you're missing components. Or is that actually that evolved? Is it less evolved? And so now we're not having an argument over my story. We're having a discussion about how good the map is. So what this enabled, it became much easier within the organization to start challenging and questioning what we were doing. And so because we had maps now, we had a common way of communicating in the organization. So alignment issues literally disappeared. Most of that seems to be artificially created because we use different instruments, income statements up here, SWOT diagrams over here, Gantt charts over here, systems graphs over here. Not very helpful if you want to commonly communicate. Secondly, it enabled us to actually challenge what we were doing and question what we were doing, because all maps are in perfect representation, so it's okay. We're not offending somebody's ego by challenging their story. Thirdly, it got us to focus on users, their needs, the actual supply chain of components involved. And fourthly, because inherently in a map we have to do movement, we're thinking about how evolved those components are. So the way in which we treat things is completely different. So by that, I mean, we'd gone all extreme programming circa 2002, 2003. And then we discovered it doesn't work everywhere. And we couldn't work out how. Once we had maps, it was pretty simple. We knew when things were in sort of genesis custom built, extreme programming was good because it's all about, you know, change. And so you want a method which encourages change. The same thing as it evolves, well, eventually it becomes commodity. So you're all about minimizing change. So things like Six Sigma, you know, dreaded waterfall, good ideas, heavy specification outsourcing. In the middle, you're all about learning. Reducing waste, things like lean and all that sort of stuff comes into play. So we started to learn that, you know, there was no such thing as one size fits all methods, and that all the components on the map were evolving if there was supply and demand competition, and that we would have inertia to change. And we started building up lists and lists of patterns. And it turned out there are about 30 common economic patterns, we call climatic patterns, 40 basic principles of organization, over 100 different forms of gameplay. And once you see it, you can run riot. And an example of that would be, I used to run strategy for a company called Canonical. They provide something called Ubuntu. And this was 2008. And we're up against, we're 2-3% of the operating system market, 2-3%, so pretty small. And we mapped out the environment, and we're up against like Microsoft and Red Hat. They've got all the resources, all the money, all the everything. We've got some really gifted people, and we've got a map and which we could communicate with. And so we used that to work out where to target. And this was 2008. We spent $500,000. It took us 18 months. We took 70% of all cloud computing. and that sounds like ridiculous, but it isn't, because one thing you learn in the military is how important situational awareness is, how important understanding your landscape when you're competing with others. And competition just, you know, competition, maps are all about understanding the landscape in which you compete. And by competition, competition is the act of multiple groups seeking some outcome, some sort of resource. And there are many ways of doing competition. We can do it by fighting with others. We call that conflict. We can do it by working with others. We call that collaboration. We can do that by helping others. We call that cooperation. So when we talk about competition, there's conflict, cooperation, collaboration. But once you can see a map, you can see, you know, you can decide we're going to conflict over here, we'll collaborate here. We may cooperate with this group in order to conflict with that group. So suddenly all of this stuff starts becoming much clearer in terms of how to actually play the game. So that's where it all started from. Whole bunch of accidents. Me thinking I need a map. Me not having done an MBA and therefore hadn't learn the right way of mapping, creating a really cheap and cheerful way of mapping, finding it useful, sharing it with others, and it's just grown from then. And it took me several years. It wasn't until about 2011. I'm sitting in a government department with a good friend of mine, and he's got a problem. I just map it out. I say, this is where the problem is. He turned around to me and said, what's that? And I said, oh, that's the problem. He said, no, that thing, it's a map. And I've never seen that before. And he's a good friend. I thought I'd shown it beforehand. We'd written something called the Better for Less paper, which helped make changes to UK government. And I was assuming that everybody else in the world had, you know, was running organizations, knew how to map because they'd done MBAs. And it was just me. And though I had been speaking about it, I then went and talked to a whole bunch of friends of mine who were at various business schools. And I started asking, how do you map your landscape? And I showed them a map and the difference between a graph and a map and how you use a map. And they were like, we don't do that. And it was just like, well, what do you use instead? And they were like, SWOT diagrams, business cases. And it was just like, oh my gosh. So, it's just grown since then. So how did you come across mapping? It's delightful to be here, but not a lot of people know my stuff.
Yeah, let me first compliment the story, because I asked you about, like, you know, what do you do professionally? But now we have a story from the bookstore visit to, in the end, naming the format or the tool.
Oh, I talked for far too long.
Yeah, no, that was really great, and I'm pretty sure our listeners will enjoy it. Yeah, what's the story of my interest in worldly mapping is, of course, that I'm looking for better ways of making people collaborate, or at least cooperate directions, what you differentiate. This is really interesting because, for example, in Polish language, there's very tough to explain difference between collaboration and cooperation. But the story behind my interest is like, preparing for this episode, I realized I've seen you alive for the first time at one of the Lean Agile Scotland events in Edinburgh some years ago. And I knew that, you know, the maps are there. Yeah, like people use it. I admit I never really went deep enough into it. Last year, I was in London at the Fast Flow conference, where one of the speakers told the story of his understanding or his interaction with worldly maps, that he also had a few years, I can't remember now exactly, was it 7 or years, just telling to himself, I need to learn it. This is going to be useful. And then he said, I spent a year really understanding it, and now he benefits from it. And taking this story to our local context, last year at Agile Coach Camp in Poland, I remembered someone proposed a topic. People propose topics as either givers or takers. So, you know, I have something to say about it, or I'm interested in it. And worldly maps appeared there. I remember that maybe, like, you know, maximum 10 people came for this session, and everyone was, a little bit, I would say, children in the fog, like, yeah, we know something. And I said, okay, now is the moment when I switch from my 7 years of thinking to 1 year of learning. And yeah, I started looking for some online resources, for some courses, etc. Probably we're going to ask you what are the good resources that you refer people to. Yeah, but it triggered that I decided to message you and invite you here. Thank you very much again for accepting our invitation. Yeah, as you know or not, listeners of this podcast are mostly people who are trying to make some impact or change in the organization, either Scrum Master, Agile coaches, consultants, yeah, all the people who say, yeah, there's a better way of working. And I'm deeply convinced now after listening to your story that Wordlay mapping is a great tool for it. And I'll comment why I see it this way. I mean, first of all, I'm the Kanban guy. I believe in visualization. So all the story that you described, and of course, it's a different visualization than we usually think of, but very useful. I also have a personal story that I tell with maps. I've been doing orienteering sports, running or cycling some years ago. And I say, well, you need to orient the map. You need to know where is the north on the map, where is the north in the reality, and then you know your landscape, as you said, right? So which way we want to go. And I see this is missing in many businesses' understanding of it, which in the end leads to this one solution fits all, like you described, right? That we don't think about do we apply the right approach, the right way of working to certain component, as you mentioned. And we don't think about that it changes over time, right? Like we are now recording this in 2024, where everything is AI because, wow, that's the novice thing, right? But I'm pretty sure that if we would listen to this episode from perspective of, 2030, that would be, come on, AI. Yeah, we have something more exciting these days. Hopefully it's going to go this way.
No, I'm going to have to dive in because there are so many good comments in there and everything else. If you don't mind, do you mind if I...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So first of all, you probably don't know this, but my grandfather was Polish.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I used to work in Warsaw for a chocolate manufacturer called Wedel.
No.
Yeah. So I have, there you are, connections. And that's why I'm delighted to be here, by the way. So second thing, when I developed mapping, which was back in 2005, I mean, I was using it for myself, but I had this idea that obviously if I developed it, therefore, there must be a much better way out there because there's all these big consultants that they must. And it's just like, here's my cheap and cheerful for those of you who haven't got an MBA. It took me at least 6 or 7 years to really realize that actually a lot of people were trying to make decisions with stories, with SWOTs, with business, with no understanding of the landscape, without it. They weren't even aware that you could. So I love your story about the 7 years, you know, because it's quite common. I actually say normally 9 years, but it's quite common for people to go, oh, I've heard of this mapping. I should have a go. And just keep on saying that and never actually have a go. In terms of actually mapping out a space, it's really simple. Who are your users? What are their needs? What are the components involved? How involved are those components? Now, any business should be able to answer those questions and have people challenge on them. The fact that most struggle with their users and the user needs, let alone understanding their supply chain, let alone considering how involved those is, you know, you would think, but I was running a business. I hadn't got a clue about all of that stuff. It was only came from mapping, once I was mapping it out, that I started to see this stuff. So the process of learning to map was a couple of weeks. but I say it normally takes about 9 years of going, I must do this, I must do this, I must do this, and then eventually, you know, something happens and somebody eventually, oh, blimey, if only I'd done this. I do this to myself all the time. Okay. So a couple of things about maps. All maps are imperfect representations of a space. So if you think about a map of Paris, it's not a perfect map of Paris. It's an imperfect map. If it was perfect, it would be one-to-one scale, which means it would be the size of Paris. Now, as a map, carrying Paris around in your pocket isn't very helpful. So all maps are imperfect representations. Secondly, all maps have a date because the map will change with time. There's no time on the map. The map itself, the landscape, changes with time. And thirdly, all maps have a perspective. So what do I mean by that? If you imagine no one's ever mapped Paris before, and you send a group of people out to map Paris, and they go and map Paris, and they come back, and you ask them a question like, what is the most important feature in Paris? They might tell you Pierre's Pizza Parlor, because they've mapped Paris from the perspective of nice places to eat pizza. So what you have to do with that knowledge when you're trying to understand a landscape, it's better to have multiple groups and multiple people go and map it out from different perspectives. It's also why when you are mapping, you want diversity of views. So if you've got a big enough group, you can break into small groups and map a space from different perspectives. And then you can ask each of those groups what matters on the map. And then you take the answers and you can aggregate them together. If you've only got enough for one group, you want to have a diversity of perspectives in there. And one of the beauties, because there's so much politics wrapped up with stories, mostly because we tell people great leaders are great storytellers, which creates all this baggage, which we just do not need. One of the things I do like about maps is the fact that it's so easy to challenge, because you start from the perspective that it's wrong, that it's imperfect. So it's not to the person. You're not saying the person's wrong. You're saying the map is wrong. And you can break into multiple groups and map from multiple perspectives. And then it's easy to aggregate those together once you've asked people what is actually important. So a couple of things from there. It's really easy to get started. Focus on user, the user needs, understand the supply chain, how evolved the components are. And I say it's really easy to get started, but it will take you often takes a long, long time just to make that jump. And I presume that's because it looks complicated. It doesn't have to be. All maps are imperfect representations of a space. There's no such thing as a perfect map, which means all views are valid, all challenges are valid. And what you're doing with a map is you're exposing your assumptions about a space so that other people can discuss it. There is no time with map, so your map is transitory. You learn that, pretty quickly. As economic patterns play on the map, things will change. Where you invest in like 2008 is not the same as 2014, is not the same as 2024. It is not fixed. And lastly, all maps have perspective. And so the way it's a good idea to get groups of people and ideally split into smaller groups, map from multiple perspectives, and then aggregate to get an overview. Because the answers to the landscape are usually in the heads of multiple people. And you need a form, a way of extracting that information into a common space that we can all share. Sorry, I wanted to answer those questions. There we are.
No, that's great, because I guess you already offered to our listeners a kind of manual how to approach the task, right? So if we decide to use maps or create maps, you explained that, very fair point. We are biased by our start point, our perception of what do we start with. And I see this as a very big challenge, especially in bigger organizations. I witnessed one session using a map like yours, where some IT people were taking decisions or jumping to solutions. We should do it A way or B way, but without understanding the wider landscape, I think they were trying, as we call it, reinvent the wheel again, right? So the solution for it was, available from a shelf or almost like a commodity. We've seen a situation where, because of their point of view, it was really hard to justify the choice of solution or approach if you've seen the wider landscape, right? Like, why do we do it?
So, lovely example. This is back in 2011, insurance company. They had a bottleneck. They had a business process graph. I know they call them maps, but they're graphs. And they had a bottleneck in terms of their process flow for getting servers into their data center. And so they put together a team of people. They spent 6 months working on this, came up with this idea of using robotics. They had an entire investment plan. It was millions of investments, wonderful return on investment calculation, all the financial figures, everything else. Wonderful presentation. They're about to go. And I was asked to have a look at this. And so the problem is they've got all the financial figures. They've got all the vendors. They've got all the business process flow. They've gone through this all. And here I am turning up. And if I go, why are you using robotics? It's just like, what the hell, a waste of time, get out of the room, blah, de, blah. So I said to them, do you mind if we just like quickly map this out? And we spent about 15 minutes arguing about the merits of whether to map or not. And then 15 minutes actually building the map. And so we had a map. And because now we have a map, I can challenge the map, not their story. So I was looking at the map, and they had, user needs compute, compute order server, server goods in, most of this stuff commodity, and then they had racks and custom built. And I simply said, why have you got custom built racks? And they said, oh, well, that's what we have. Oh, what are the modifications you're making to servers? Because they had modify servers. And it was like, well, the servers we buy don't fit our racks. So we take cases off, draw new holes, add new plates in order to get them to fit our racks. Oh, and that's why you need robotics. That's the bottleneck, yeah. And so somebody in the room, if you just there and then, went, why aren't we using standard racks? And it was that they were able, but now these people were not daft. This is really important to get across. These people were simply trapped by a pre-existing story. So at some point in the past, it had made sense because there were no such thing as standard racks. They have, these custom, and it had just built up. And so they'd constantly been looking at improving process flow. But process flow is only one thing. You've also got evolutionary flow. So when you look at a map, within the lines, there's process flow between the nodes. But you've also got evolutionary flow because the components themselves are evolving. And so they'd never challenge that. And so pretty quickly, the whole idea of getting robotics no longer made any sense. And shortly after that, an hour after that, they'd realized they're an insurance company. Compute was a utility. What are we messing around with? Compute, full stop. Now, I suppose the entire process was probably about an hour and a half from we spent 6 months working, we're going to spend millions on robotics to what the hell were we thinking about? And none of these people were daft. And these people were all trapped by context and trapped by past stories. And this is the most common thing I see. Trapped by stories, people not understanding their users, their user needs, the components involved, how evolved those components are, not understanding, you can apply multiple different methods. There's no such thing as the one-size-fits-all magic method, not having an effective means of communication, which is principally why we have business alignment issues all over the place, and not having a mechanism of challenge. And that's just the basics. Just by the simple act of mapping will help you just get, and then it gets into even more interesting stuff you start to discover. Horror stories all over the place.
Okay, great story. I believe this is a good example, what you described, that we could convince or at least, attract people to use it, because it may take us out of our cognitive biases, right? That we look for confirmation of our ideas, our approaches. And of course, like you said, well, it could end up with like multi-million savings, right? That we don't opt for for custom-built solutions if we change the view. Yeah.
Cognitive biases. I love that. So one of the things I realized once we started mapping, and lots of people were getting involved and questioning why we were doing things. One of the things I had realized is how we actually did investment in the company beforehand or projects beforehand. And it was really simple. I would probably read an article in HBR.
Uh-huh.
Think, oh, that's a good idea. We should have one of those. Some group would go off and work out the cost of building one of those. People will then add return on investment calculations to work out how much market they needed to justify the cost. Somebody from marketing would just get some data to basically justify, oh, there's definitely a $1 trillion market in kitten internet or whatever. And in fact, the entire process was simply justifying me reading an article and thinking, oh, that was a good idea, without any understanding of the landscape of the environment, zero situational awareness. Now it's, for me now, it's completely different. I mean, it's a world apart from that world. And I've got to say, because you mentioned like AI and One of the interesting things is there are so many patterns, and we don't have time for all the patterns. But one of them is every time we industrialize a technology, we get cloud, we get inertia to the change because of pre-existing practices. That's one pattern. You don't have choice, because what happens is it's not only about efficiency, it enables new practices, which gives us speed and new sources of value. So you don't have choice, you're going to have inertia, there's going to be new practices, there's going to be creation of new things. So you get a list of basics, and that happened with cloud and serverless, and it's happening with large language models. But you also learn that you're in competition with others, so you end up doing more stuff, which basically means you never save any money, you just do more things. But you never save stuff. If you do fire people, you end up hiring them back even more expensive rates later on. And you saw this with cloud, and the consultants would run around saying cloud is going to reduce your IT budget and you'll be able to get rid of loads of your staff and blah de blah. And so a bunch of people in companies thought, we'll tell the CFO our IT budget's going down and we'll get rid of people. Isn't that great? Of course, they're in competition with others. This is Jevons' paradox, the cold question, 1896. You end up discovering, you have to do more stuff. So you end up spending just as much money, but doing vastly more. And you also have to end up hiring back the people you've just fired. I used to all these CIOs of these big companies on study tours around Silicon Valley. I used to go and visit my friends at places like Netflix. And it's ever so funny. They would always, whenever you took them, these companies had often gone through this sort of technology change, get rid of a whole bunch of people, and they were now realizing they need people, and they would always ask companies like Netflix, where do you get your people from? And my friends at Netflix would turn around and say, from companies like you. You had them. And so you saw the same service, and you're seeing exactly the same large language models. We're seeing heavy industrialization, a new set of practices, prompt engineering, conversational programming, all that sort of stuff, explosion of new higher order systems, whole bunch of consultants running around saying it's going to reduce your IT budgets. No, it's not. You're going to be able to fire loads of people. You're going to wish you hadn't. I mean, it's same repeating patterns over and over.
True. Oh my, Simon, great stories. I hope that what our listeners will hear or heard, if they listen to this episode by now, will make them more interested in at least starting their 7 to 9 years period of thinking about worldly mapping. Or to some of them moving from this phase to learning. If you could recommend any first steps to take, resources to look at, is there anything that you can recommend?
Christoph Daniels. Chris Daniels. He's based in Poland. Mm-hmm. He runs wardleymaps.com. So you'll find him at wardleymaps on Twitter. Really big guy.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, we're going to add, of course, links to the description of the episode. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so just wardleymaps.com is Chris Daniels. You'll find he's got links to people doing training and all the rest of it as well. There is Ben Moisseur, Learn Wardley Mapping. He's got a site with some really simple introduction. He's also got a whole bunch of these strashy cards and other things that he's built around with maps and all the rest of it. It's a really fascinating.
Oh,
there's my unfinished book, which is medium.com/Wardley Maps. I started writing that book in 2008, actually. I think that's about the second or third version of it on the medium.com/maps. I promise at some point in the future, I will actually get around to finishing it. There's about 14, 15 books written on map with have mapping out there. The AWS has a book, which is on reaching cloud velocity, I think it is, or it's on the shelf. Yeah, Reaching Cloud Velocity, AWS. There's also Value Flywheel Effect. Dave Anderson has lots of mapping. There's Flow Architectures. So there's about 14 books out there on mapping. So where do you start? Read the book. Go have a look at Chris's wardleymaps.com or Ben's Wardley Mapping. You'll find just search Wardley Maps. And then there's or come along to a conference. We have MapCamp, which occurs once a year. It's an event, a virtual event. We do it all virtual. It's so easy, just search up MapCamp 2024. And, you know, we get a crowd of interesting speakers and interesting mappers. So I suppose that's where to start. But really, all you have to do is you just ask the question, who are the users? What are the user needs? What components do I need to meet those needs?
Yeah.
How evolved those components are? And you've got a map, and just share it with others and allow them to challenge what you've done and also add other components. It's as simple as that.
Challenge the map. That's a very good, I guess, conclusion for our conversation. It recalls now, I guess, one of the Adam Grant book about like moving from, you know, people conflict to task conflict. So let's have a task and let's have a conversation around it. I guess map could be a great artifact to facilitate, to start such conversation. Simon, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for great stories.
Oh, pleasure. Delight.
We will, of course, share all the links to materials that you mentioned. And yeah, maybe you will see one of our listeners at your event or some other occasions.
Fair enough. Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tyle rozmowy z Simonem. Teraz przede mną niełatwe zadanie, ponieważ mówimy o mapie, mówimy o czymś wizualnym, a z racji tego, że podcast Kanban przy kawie jest głównie kanałem audio, to muszę zacząć o tym opowiadać słowno-muzycznie. No, może nie muzycznie. Ale oczywiście warto powiedzieć, że w opisie odcinka znajdziecie link do wpisu na blogu, na stronie internetowej podcastu, a dla tych z Was, którzy śledzą nas również na YouTubie, niedługo pojawi się film wizualizujący właśnie mapy Wordleya. Spróbujmy sobie opowiedzieć taką historię, bo myślę, że narracja może tutaj najbardziej pomóc, a więc chcemy zbudować jakiś projekt, na przykład rozwiązania software as a service, strony internetowej, aplikacji mobilnej, czegoś, co będzie oferowało jakąś usługę. No i wiemy, że na tą usługę składa się, można powiedzieć, nasz content, nasza treść, nasze rozwiązanie użytkownika, ale też, żeby je zaoferować, mamy bardzo wiele różnych elementów. Potrzebujemy aplikacji, potrzebujemy strony internetowej, potrzebujemy rozwiązania, być może chmurowego, być może potrzebujemy rozwiązania związanego z, nie wiem, komunikacją mailową albo jakąkolwiek inną. Teraz zastanówmy się w takiej osi pionowej, a więc takiej osi, która idzie od dołu do góry, gdzie u góry mielibyśmy te rzeczy, które w naszym rozwiązaniu najbardziej, czy najistotniej stanowią wartość dla klienta, no właśnie przede wszystkim przez niego postrzeganą. Czy jakiś użytkownik wybiera aplikację dlatego, że jest napisana w jakimś języku? Prawdopodobnie nie. Czy jakiś użytkownik wybiera jakieś rozwiązanie dlatego, że jest oparte o jedno rozwiązanie chmurowe, a nie drugie? No, jeśli tu mówimy oczywiście o rozwiązaniach typu B2C, a więc dla klienta końcowego, to często takie elementy, takie właśnie węzły, nodes, tak to chyba należałoby powiedzieć, znajdą się na tej osi stosunkowo nisko. A więc one po pierwsze nie są widoczne z perspektywy klienta, jakie to jest rozwiązanie, i nie stanowią dla niego wartości. Nie, po drugiej stronie, a więc wysoko na tej osi, pojawią się te rzeczy, które naprawdę nas wyróżniają i które stanowią wartość dla klienta. A więc być może jest to kwestia łatwości obsługi naszej aplikacji, być może jest to kwestia na przykład spersonalizowanego wsparcia, no właśnie chociażby za pomocą ludzi, a nie chatbotu. Tu sobie tak zażartuję, ale no właśnie ciekawa sprawa. Z jednej strony mamy nurt pójścia w te wszystkie rozwiązania oparte o no, tak zwane AI, a bardziej powinniśmy powiedzieć raczej modele językowe. Natomiast to jest ciekawe, że chociażby za oceanem słyszy się reklamy, że oferujemy usługi i wsparcie oferuje prawdziwy człowiek. A więc próbujemy się wyróżnić na rynku tym, że nie rozmawiamy z Janiną Magnetofon, tylko z właśnie prawdziwym człowiekiem, który odbierze od nas telefon i spróbuje rozwiązać nasz problem. Zwróćcie uwagę, że to będzie bardzo wysoko, oczywiście nie dla wszystkich klientów, nie dla wszystkich produktów, natomiast może być to coś, co będzie tym naszym wyróżnikiem. I teraz, jeśli te elementy rozrzucimy sobie wokół tej osi Y, a więc od tych, no powiedziałbym, mało widocznych, a tym samym może mniej istotnych dla klienta, do tych bardzo widocznych, to nadajemy temu drugi wymiar, a więc wymiar poziomy, oś X. Wszystkie węzły, elementy, które zidentyfikowaliśmy, będą również rozłożone na tej osi poziomej i na tej osi poziomej będziemy mieli No właśnie, trudne słowo do przetłumaczenia. Komodytyzacja to nie jest dokładnie to samo, co utowarowienie w takim komodyfikacja, tak chyba to słowo po polsku brzmi. A więc można powiedzieć upowszechnienie albo łatwość danego rozwiązania. Tak myślę, że moglibyśmy tutaj to przetłumaczyć. Będą rzeczy, które są po prostu dostępne, tak jak energia elektryczna albo jak rozwiązania chmurowe. Ale są też takie rzeczy, które musimy zbudować sami. Być może będzie to właśnie element naszego rozwiązania, naszej przewagi konkurencyjnej, że będziemy oferowali jakiś produkt, którego nie ma, jakieś podejście, którego nie oferuje nikt inny. Być może w naszej aplikacji na podstawie tych takich klocków, można powiedzieć niżej leżących, zbudujemy jakiś naprawdę innowacyjny sposób interakcji z klientem, jego flow przez naszą aplikację, być może design będzie naszym wyróżnieniem, czy wspomniana obsługa klienta. No i teraz jeśli się zastanowimy, to na tej osi X będziemy mieli rozwiązania, które są właśnie, jak to się mówi, do wzięcia z półki. Prawdopodobnie dla klienta nie będzie miało to znaczenia, czy my włożymy bardzo dużo wysiłku w rozwiązanie mailingowe samodzielnie, czy weźmiemy, kupimy dostępne rozwiązanie albo dokonamy jakiejś kustomizacji, dostosowania rozwiązania istniejącego. Ale klient na pewno by odczuł, gdybyśmy poszli właśnie w jakąś bardzo standardowe rozwiązanie, które no nie jest szyte na miarę, jeśli on tego potrzebuje i on to postrzega w innym obszarze naszej aplikacji. Co teraz? Okazuje się, że powstaje mapa, a więc powstaje mapa, gdzie na jednej osi, osi X, mamy tą taką dostępność tego, co chcemy zrobić. No i tutaj oczywiście nie jest, myślę, jakimś bardzo odkrywczym, że nie ma sensu wynajdować koła na nowo, nie musimy budować własnego systemu operacyjnego, żeby oferować aplikację. Nie musimy budować sami rozwiązania chmurowego, skoro możemy skorzystać w taki sposób, który jest niewidoczny, który nie uszczupla tego rozwiązania użytkownika, z rozwiązania komercyjnie dostępnego. Idąc w osi pionowej, powinniśmy się skupić na tych rzeczach, które są właśnie i tutaj też wpinają się podejścia, które są wartościowe, widoczne dla użytkownika i które są naszym wyróżnikiem i tam warto naszą energię, pieniądze, fokus wkładać. Pamiętajmy o tym, że te rzeczy się będą przesuwały, będą się zmieniały oczekiwania klientów, być może zmiana pokoleniowa spowoduje, że ktoś nie chce mieć kontaktu z człowiekiem, a raczej z botem albo nie ta sama grupa docelowa. Z drugiej strony coś, co dzisiaj wymaga zbudowania czegoś, no właśnie, customowego od zera, za kilka lat może stać się właśnie takim gotowym produktem z półki. Zwróćmy uwagę, ile rzeczy, które, no, jeśli pracujecie w branży IT lat naście, które kiedyś były rozwijane przez firmy samodzielnie, bardzo drogo, dzisiaj są po prostu, mówiąc tak kolokwialnie, do wyklikania. I to powinniśmy również mieć na uwadze, ponieważ no bardzo łatwo jest pójść w to, że będziemy szukali bardzo takich fancy rozwiązań technologicznych, a niekoniecznie, a nie tylko technologicznych, ale właśnie komunikacyjnych czy jakichś innych, bo lubimy, bo umiemy, bo robiliśmy to w przeszłości, ale pytanie, czy to naprawdę jest dobra inwestycja naszego czasu, czy jest to inwestycja też długoterminowa, bo jeżeli widzimy bardzo mocny ruch wzdłuż tej osi X w stronę od tych rozwiązań customowych, w stronę rozwiązań bardzo ogólnych, to może to jest duży wysiłek, a za chwilę okaże się właściwie czymś, co no, nasi konkurenci czy my sami moglibyśmy już kupić w tak cudzysłowie znacznie taniej. No i mamy mapę, wokół której możemy poprowadzić dialog, na co kładziemy nacisk, czym się chcemy wyróżnić, jakie trendy w przesuwaniu się w osi X szczególnie widzimy. I to jest też istotne z punktu widzenia, myślę, wielu was, słuchaczki i słuchacze, a więc doboru sposobu pracy. Pomyślmy o tym, że jeśli coś jest właśnie dostępne z półki, to być może nie trzeba tego rozwiązywać w sposób, uwaga, zwinny. Być może można to zrobić projektowo, można to zakupić, można to zrobić linowo, a więc w taki bardzo ustandaryzowany sposób. Jeśli jesteśmy w tym obszarze, pasie na osi X, kiedy szukamy rzeczywiście rozwiązań customowych, nietypowych, robionych po raz pierwszy, to być może tutaj różnego rodzaju podejścia zwinne będą właściwe, ponieważ no, będziemy tutaj iterować, będziemy tutaj w sposób ciągły tą wartość budować. Oczywiście mamy też tą skrajną część osi X, takich niskich wartości, zaraz przy osi Y, gdzie mamy rozwiązania, gdzie nawet takie standardowe, tradycyjne podejścia oparte o długie iteracje będą niewystarczające. Być może tutaj będzie potrzebny jakiś naprawdę startupowy pomysł podejścia do tego odkrycia, czy odkrywania i budowania będzie należyty. Zwróćmy uwagę, że tak jak w wywiadzie Simon mówi, możemy dzięki takiej mapie i dialogowi nad tą mapą odejść od moje versus twoje, myśląc o rozwiązaniach czy punktach widzenia. Raczej zobaczmy to wspólnie na tej mapie, zastanówmy się, czy to będzie wędrowało w górę czy w dół, czy to będzie wędrowało w lewo czy w prawo i rzeczywiście budując strategię czy konkretnego rozwiązania, bo tutaj podałem przykład takiej aplikacji webowej, czy po prostu w ogóle naszej firmy, okaże się, że no, być może ta dyskusja przejdzie bardziej w merytorykę niż w obudowywanie się w swoich obozach. I chyba tyle. Chciałbym Was zachęcić do tego, żebyście odwiedzili stronę poświęconą temu odcinkowi. Jeśli nie subskrybujecie jeszcze naszego kanału na YouTubie, to zapraszam, bo tam będzie film. I chciałbym usłyszeć Wasz feedback, czy jest to ciekawe, czy chcemy temu więcej poświęcić czasu i macie swoje doświadczenia z Worldly Mappingiem. Jeśli tak, to koniecznie dajcie znać. Dziękuję Wam pięknie. Przed nami kolejne odcinki, kolejne wywiady. Zapraszam jak zwykle do tego, że jeśli chcecie, podzielcie się tym, jeśli możecie, podzielcie się tym odcinkiem z Waszymi kolegami, koleżankami, a jeśli chcecie, możecie nas zawsze wesprzeć na patronite.pl/kanban. Do usłyszenia, mówił Radek Orszewski.